This little song that I'm singing about, people you know is true. If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they would say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be alright. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night, they was all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. To employ me at office, the number I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man is working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him $1 an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now guess that you can see what a black man have to do. This is, if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hoe. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you's white, she's all right. If you's brown, stick around. But if you's black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're continuing with our program, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, with Richard Haass and E.J. Dionne.
I think when it comes to our tools, we ought to look at all of them and not just focus on the military. And then also, we ought not to be looking for things to do abroad. We ought to be very wary of wars of choice in particular. And we ought to be basically preserving our resources to fix what needs fixing here at home. Again, which will position us in the long run so we can do more in the world if we so choose. I want to discourage the emergence of any 21st century equivalent to Germany or the Soviet Union in the 20th century. Right now, the United States has this respite. There's no peer competitor, to use the long term. Well, I'd like to keep it that way. And if all the same one emerges, I want to be able to cope with it. The only way we can discourage the emergence of a real rival or deal with one if it happens all the same is by being strong here at home. Again, that argues for restoring the balance of American national security somewhat away from foreign policy, more on what we have to do here at home.
One of the things that was fun about reading the book is your short portraits of different countries in different parts of the world. And I was on the one hand, a little bit blue reading your section on Europe, since I have a lot of affection for the democracies of Europe. And I was actually heartened reading your section on China, not because I don't want China to succeed as a nation, but because you talk very clearly about the problems they face, and those who make a declinist argument and want to say China will dominate, you're quite clear about the problems that China faces. So talk particularly about Europe and China.
Okay, Europe. Look, the good news about Europe is that it's not going to be nearly as exciting in the 21st century as it was in the 20th century. That's good. Good news. As I used to say when I had the Middle East account at the White House, that my goal was to make the Middle East boring, and I clearly failed miserably. Europe has, for the most part, become boring, and we ought to try to keep it that way. It's not going to be the locale of the great clashes of the 21st century. And that's a wonderful thing. Europe was way too exciting in the 20th century. The dark side of this, or the bad side, is Europe is not going to be the partner for the United States moving forward that it was over the last four decades. The Atlantic era of American foreign policy is largely coming to an end. I don't say this to celebrate it. I just simply point it out. Europe doesn't have the capacity, given the low rates of economic growth. Even if it gets out of the Eurozone crisis, Europe is not growing. It doesn't have the outlook anymore. Bob Gates, when he was Secretary of Defense, often talked publicly about the changing political culture of Europe. It's true. Europe is just not going to be willing and able to be the partner that we have come to know. The good news is, you know, in some cases we'll have other partners and so forth, but that's just simply, it's not an anti-European argument, it's a fact of life observation. In terms of China, I'm struck by how much of the debate, particularly in this city in Washington, is about China's inevitable emergence as a great power rival. And it seems to me that that gets it wrong in two ways. One, I'm not so sure China emerges as a great power. Just because its GDP grows considerably, never forget that you've got it's got a big denominator, four times ours. And that's a real sponge for resources. Plus, China faces massive domestic problems, from environmental degradation on an enormous scale to a political system that's not nearly as dynamic as the economy, to an economy that's not nearly as dynamic as it was. How will China fare against a backdrop of 6 or 7% growth as opposed to 10 or 11% growth? So I'm worried about parts of China, particularly the emergence of nationalism. But Chinese strength, I think, is exaggerated. People who simply extend in a linear fashion Chinese trajectory from the last three decades to the next three decades are just ignoring lots of realities, in addition to which, you know, lots of the low-hanging fruit has already been taken in China. It's going to be much harder for China to do well going ahead. Plus, I don't think the second half of the prediction is right. I don't see China as necessarily a declared rival on every issue. Indeed, it ought to be the goal of American diplomacy that it's not. It's a very different century if the United States and China find some limited ways to cooperate, be it dealing, say, now with a North Korea and Iran or Syria. Look at the range of outcomes, depending upon what China does, to dealing with economic issues or climate change issues or just about any issue you can think of. So China will become more significant. But shaping how China uses its growing strength against a backdrop also of growing Chinese internal challenges, I actually think is a big diplomatic foreign policy challenge for the United States.
One area where I suspect a lot of people on both sides will sort of have some differences with you is where you talk about both democracy promotion and humanitarian intervention. I think you try to write carefully about those things and make clear you are in favor of spreading democracy, but you talk about the danger of democracy promotion as a central goal. And you have an interesting sort of switch of doctrine, if you will, where idea of humanitarian intervention has been enshrined as the responsibility to protect a Star Wars character, R2P, and you propose that it be changed to the responsibility to respond, R2R. Can you talk about all of that?
Well, sure. Well, democracy promotion, look, democracy is a worthy thing, and there's a whole school of thought, a whole literature that mature democracies tend to obviously treat their own citizens better as well as their neighbors better. The problem is mature democracies are very hard to bring about. Immature democracies can be quite dangerous. They can be quite vulnerable to being hijacked by nationalism. And also, it's very hard for outsiders to say, even if they want to bring about mature democracies, how to do it. So we could be facing a prolonged era of incomplete or immature democracies in much of the world, which could be very vulnerable to nationalism, could be very intolerant of minorities within their borders, could be very aggressive towards their neighbors. And indeed, I think we're seeing a lot of that in the greater Middle East today. So I just raise questions about what it is we can accomplish. And I'd also say, on a pragmatic level, we, the United States, need to be prepared to deal with non-democracies. We have to deal with non-democratic China on lots of challenges. Do we simply sit aside and say, look, until you guys democratize, we're not going to work with you on things? Of course not. We don't have that luxury. Any more than we had the luxury during the Cold War not to deal with the Soviet Union on stabilizing the arms race, because the Soviet Union was an authoritarian system. Foreign policy has got to be pragmatic. It's got to be about priorities. And I would say promoting stability in the world as a priority ought to be fairly high. On the question of humanitarian intervention, again, you know, the world, what, about 7-8 years ago, signed up to this idea of the responsibility to protect. As soon as the world did, though, there was kind of a collective buyer's remorse. And ever since then, the world hasn't acted on it, either because many countries are against it now because they say, hold it. If we open up the borders, if you will, of a certain country, we're setting a precedent. For all we know, this will be used against our sovereignty. So when you see the Russians or the Chinese or the Indians or others getting very nervous about this concept, that's why. They're nervous about any compromise of sovereignty. And many governments are also very worried about the price tag. If you actually believe that there is a collective responsibility to protect, well, that means, well, where's the collective responsibility then to protect in Syria? I haven't noticed one country volunteering for the sort of international military effort that would be required. Tom Friedman wrote, a spot-on column over the weekend saying, if you're serious about Syria, wanting to do something, forget about no-fly zones, you know, forget about all this stuff people are banding about, seal off the country, put in hundreds of thousands of people for a decade, and basically deal with it. Well, people can start forming the line over there, but they're not going to. That's too high of a price to pay for too uncertain of an outcome. So we set this global standard that we're not prepared to live with. So my view is, rather than be so cynical or rather than raising expectations, let's just say we're going to have a responsibility to respond. We're going to look at each situation for what it is. We're going to determine what might be the most appropriate response, what it is we're willing and able to come up with in the way of resources, rather than holding out an image of international relations that simply doesn't exist.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I look out and I see a land young and lovely, hard and strong. 15,000 years we've danced your praises, prayed our thanks, and we've just begun. This is my country, young and growing, free and flowing sea to sea. Yes, this is my country. Walks the high country, giving free wild samples and setting an example how to give. Yes, this is my country, retching and turning like a baby learning how to live. Another way to love. Soldier Blue, Soldier Blue, can't you see that there's another way?
And now back to Foreign Policy Begins at Home with Richard Haass and E.J. Dionne.
By the way, you should know this book is full of aphorisms. There's one that I think does capture something important. The United States does not need the world's permission to act, but it does often need the world's support to succeed. But there is one aphorism that every reviewer who wants to go after Richard will use, but I'd love you to defend it because I think it's defensible here and elsewhere.
Are you giving them ammunition?
They're going to find it themselves. Here, and I'm giving you a chance to respond preemptively. Okay. I suppose we should. Here and elsewhere in foreign policy, inconsistency can be a virtue. Explain yourself on that.
Well, and some of the things we were just talking about, it's very hard to say in a certain situation, we're always going to put promotion of democracy first, or we're always going to put the saving of innocent lives first, or we're never going to tolerate certain outcomes. We have to be very careful about it, because, again, you never want to conduct national security or foreign policy in a vacuum. You've got to look at the local realities, what it is you can accomplish and what price, and then you got to ask yourself, what's the opportunity cost? If I do what I think it will take to succeed in this instance, what will that mean for all my other interests around that world? What will it mean for all the challenges and commitments I've got here at home? I do not have unlimited resources. Policymakers do not have unlimited time. The political system doesn't have unlimited bandwidth. So what is it we want to choose? That forces you into inconsistency. And that to me is that's the beginning of a mature public policy.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a couple more questions, and then I want to open this up to the audience. Something I think a lot of people would be interested in is you very specifically criticize the idea of a war on terror. And you note that Al-Qaeda did great harm on the cheap, meaning that it was not at all a powerful group. Before the day before or the day after 9/11. Could you talk about why the war on terror is actually a bad frame for fighting terrorism?
It's not a very helpful frame for a number of reasons. One is the weapons sometimes of terrorists need not to be weapons, box cutters, available at most hardware stores. So for that. Second of all, they don't wear uniforms. It's not like terrorists wave their hands and say, here we are. There's no battlefield. There's no Gettysburg of the war on terror. Everything's, every shopping mall, every finish line at a marathon suddenly is part of this struggle. There's not going to be a Battleship Missouri ceremony at the end of it where these groups are going to say, okay, we give in. Now we're willing to live normal lives and let you live a normal life. It's just not going to happen. This is now part of the infrastructure, you will. Terrorism is now part of the framework of our lives. The analogy I always use is disease. Disease is part of the framework of our lives, and what we do is we go after disease when we can. We try to go after viruses. We try to protect ourselves with all sorts of mechanisms, and then when we get sick, we try to respond. We try to build resilience into our systems, hence the healthcare system. Same thing with terrorism. You end up having a layered approach. You don't eliminate it, but you try to keep it at a manageable layer. You don't want terrorists to essentially succeed in disrupting your lives any more than is absolutely necessary.
Now, my last question is about a whole section of the book, a whole series of subjects that I don't think you ever expected to write about, where you talk about the last part of the book are proposals on energy, education, infrastructure, economic growth, and political reform. And for the record, I have some disagreements with you about unions, about how to approach the deficit, about trade to
some
degree.
Which is why the Council on Foreign Relations won't be merging with Brookings.
Right. Brookings probably maybe closer to you on these questions. But I also was surprised and pleasantly surprised that by some very interesting things. You do endorse filibuster reform. You endorse suggest compulsory voting as something that can work, something I thought my friend Tom Mann and I were among the only people who were for. You talk about popular election of the President of the United States. I'd like to ask you, what was it like to think about a whole series of questions that you probably had not thought about since you were an undergraduate?
Well, my critics will say it showed that these were a whole set of questions I hadn't thought about for a long time.
So we're getting rid of all the criticism now, so from here forward, everything should be praise of this book.
Well, what led me to think about a lot of that was when I looked at the challenges facing this country, particularly domestically, so many of them had less to do with the substance of the challenge than the politics which precluded our coming together to meet the challenge. So you scratch an economic problem or a schools problem or an infrastructure problem or an immigration problem, and very quickly, you don't need to do deep archaeology, very quickly you get to the political functioning or lack thereof. of our system. So it seemed to me experts can spend all their time trafficking in ideas about this is what we ought to do, whether it's on gun control or immigration reform, what have you. But unless you figure out how to get the political marketplace, if you will, to respond more to the general interest rather than the special interest, you're not going to get very far. And so what I try to do is think about reforms that could make the system somewhat more responsive to majorities rather than to intense, impassioned minorities. The problem with doing that, as I say, is the very forces that lead the political system to the place it's in will resist this kind of change. It's the same reason, by the way, you're not going to get reform of the UN Security Council. Any conceivable reform always has winners and losers, and shockingly enough, the losers are going to resist it. So I ended up thinking that, you know, it makes sense to still traffic in ideas, to put out these thoughts. I do think, though, it's going to require either there's one or two ways things turn out better. One is the way I fear, which is only after a crisis. After we have a terrible crisis and essentially business as usual is no longer sustainable, the problem with that is that we will pay an enormous collective price for the crisis. So this is not the way any of us should want things to happen. The alternative is there is something of a new majority or plurality for the sorts of reforms that we need. I think it could come about, it sounds a bit hackneyed, but from leadership that was willing to in some ways combine what I would say is the best of FDR, the fireside chats that educate and create a context for policy reform, and Lyndon Johnson, then some good retail politics to try to ring it about. Is it a long shot? Sure. Is it possible? Definitely. In no way have I given up. You know, that old saw of Churchill's that Americans can be counted on to do the right thing, but only after they've tried everything else. Okay, well, we're busy trying everything else. And the real question for me is whether we get to this in time before the crisis, if you will, forces us to undertake reform on far worse terms. And that is something we should, as a polity, want to avoid at almost any cost. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but I really think that is the question. I would simply say, I don't think we have forever. When you look at projections, for example, of things like entitlement obligations 5-10 years out, my hunch is that's roughly the timeline. I think we've bought a few years with some of the budgetary reforms of the last couple of years. I think the energy transformation has also bought us some welcome time. Hopefully we'll do immigration reform. That would be welcome. So we're doing some of the right things. But there are some deep overhangs, if you will, that we've got to deal with. So I don't believe we've got an unlimited window to get things right.
Let me open it up to the audience. We have a mic going around. Sir, right in the front.
Oda Aberdeen, the Capital Trust Group. Richard, in 91, the U.S. led a major intervention where everybody was on board. The U.N. was on board. The Japanese were on board. The Arabs paid for it. The U.S. came out making money, more admired, more respected. In 2003...
Closer to the mic, yeah.
The U.S. was not really backed by people in the region, by the Europeans. Why is that?
The question was about why was there so much international support for the United States in 1990-91, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and obviously the contrast with the 2003 Iraq War. The reason is that the 1990-91 Iraq War was based upon the one thread of international law and principle that most of the world signs up to, which is the idea of sovereignty and the idea that territory should not be acquired by physical force. So when Saddam Hussein did that, the world rallied around that principle, rallied around the United States taking the lead. You had this unprecedented coalition. And I think also the fact that U.S. war aims were kept limited, again, kept the world focused on this principle. In 2003, it was very different. It was a very different approach. It was to transform another society, undertaking a preventive military action. For such things, there's virtually no international support and much more questionable international legal underpinnings. So it comes as no surprise that the second Iraq War, if you will, enjoyed much less international support. It just shows, you know, the phrase international community is bandied about all the time. But it's actually an inaccurate term. In some areas, there actually is a degree of international community, but in most areas, there's precious little.
messages from Access Sacramento.